It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Wow, it's so good to have you guys back here on Money for Lunch. Just excited. My Money for Lunch tribe, my Money for Lunch. You know, we got to come up with some kind of, name for our, Money for Lunchers. Not so. I don't know. The Money for Lunch Leaders. Ooh. Anyway, appreciate you being here. I am excited. I have Denise R. Green right now on the show. I kid you not. Denise R. Green is a speaker, writer, executive coach committed to helping people go from burnt out to brilliant. I love that. To go from burnt out to brilliant. After a successful career with Oracle Corporation and Charles Schwab, Denise funded Brilliance, a corporation whose purpose is to unleash human potential. For more than a decade, she and her team have helped thousands of people feel less stressed and have more ease and fulfillment in all areas of their lives. Her new book, Work-Life Brilliance, Tools to Break Stress and Create the Life and Health You Crave, is about reigniting one's internal spark. Denise R. Green, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you so much, Bert. I'm very happy to be here.
Excited to have you here, and I want to start off by asking you, here you are, you've written this book, Work-Life Brilliance, which I love the name, not Work-Life Balance, but Work-Life Brilliance, Tools to Break Stress and Create the Life and Health You Crave. Talk about this a little bit. What was the motivation to write this book?
So I feel like I've had write a book on my bucket list for really as long as I can remember. And I was very sick. I was burned out myself, and it wasn't time to write a book. And I was basically surviving versus thriving. And the only work I could really do was my client work. And my clients, even though they weren't in as bad a shape as I was health-wise, they were on track to be. And the theme that ran through all of my clients' challenges was stress. They didn't often use the word burnout, but they were on their way to burnout, which is the most extreme version of stress, when chronic stress adds up to serious health problems, serious mental anguish, divorce, you name it, all the problems that come from chronic stress. So it was through my own experiences and through working with my clients that I shifted my focus from, I thought I would be writing a book on leadership, and I shifted my focus away to writing a book about how to relight that spark that's in all of us, but that feels like it might have been snuffed out by all the stuff of life.
I like that. That's excellent. Okay, so not to get too much into your business here, but when you say you were sick, was this a physical ailment that you were dealing with that kind of threw you for a loop, or is this illness related to the stress?
It was actually some of it was stress-related. So I had been diagnosed with PTSD about a year after the birth of my daughter, and that came from all the hormonal changes that happened, and then extreme sleep deprivation, not just the normal parenting sleep deprivation. But so my brain was already fried, but I was on the way. I was on the way back. I was getting back. I was much, much better. And then I came down with Lyme disease, and I also, post-divorce, moved into a house that we didn't know had black mold. And I am genetically, even though black mold is bad for everybody, I have a genetic mutation that makes it even worse for me. So it was, I don't know how to explain the symptoms other than mental confusion, couldn't breathe very well, chronic fatigue. So it was about all I could do to keep things running.
Yeah, that's a lot to deal with. All right, let's talk about this. burnout? Because I think burnout is sometimes, I don't know, is it overused? But when you're thinking burnout, when you're talking to your clients of burnout, what's the definition? What are some of the symptoms that I should be looking for when it comes to burnout?
If you are dreading your day when you get up, I argue that you are probably burnt out and something serious needs to shift. Now, there's a difference between being a little bit anxious about your day because you have so much going on. That's going to produce chronic stress. But when you get to the point where you are dreading your day because of either the work you're doing is dreadful, or the people around you are dreadful, or the thoughts you have about yourself and others and the world are dreadful and you just want to stay in bed, you are burned out.
You know, listening to you there for a moment, it also all of a sudden it reminded me of Jeff Foxworthy. You know, if you know, you might be a redneck if blah blah blah, right? So
yes,
you might be experiencing burnout if you're, you know, if what do you call it? If you're afraid to go to work, or you know, I'm sure there's a whole litany of things that we could do on that.
Right.
You know, and it's interesting too because I think we as a society have somehow gotten into this mess. And this has been going on ever since I entered the corporate world where, you know, working long and working hard is kind of some kind of a badge of honor, right? Hey, I'm working 15 hours a day. You know, I'm here at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm sacrificing my life, my health, and my family. Yeah. And you know, I think that has to stop. I think we have to make a shift because what I see happening, and I want to get your take on this, Denise, is we have this environment where, you know, working long hours is encouraged and kind of rewarded versus being productive. And then that's leading to, again, burnout and stress and health issues and divorce. But it's also leading to people just sucking down caffeine and energy drinks all day long.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I think we're starting to move away from that. And by the way, this is a very American belief that working long hours is a badge of honor. If you look at the research done on the most happy, most brilliant communities that have the most purpose, that have the most longevity, that have the most vibrant health, most of them are not in the United States, and they call them blue zones. And, you know, often one of them is in the Mediterranean, where people spend time, they don't even call it exercising. They just walk everywhere, so they're moving. They spend time with people they love, family and friends, and they work, but it doesn't feel like work. It feels like purpose. And so we need to get away from this badge of honor of working long hours, and we need to look at, like you said, how productive are you? And there's been some great articles out recently about the greatest achievers and thinkers of our time, of you know, any time, Darwin, Thoreau, Edison, they worked four-hour days. They took walks. They took naps. That is what your brain is designed to do. If you ever sit at your computer waiting for an epiphany, good luck with that. That is not how the brain works. So if you don't allow that space, whether it's, you know, listening to a great podcast in your car, we have to carve out these moments, or sitting at a red light and doing a little mini breathing meditation. We have to create these moments where our fried brains can calm down, the cortisol levels in our body can calm down, and we can actually be more responsive and reflective in that next moment and choose mindfully what we want to do and how we want to do it.
Yeah, and what is so interesting is I've talked to so many people that eventually do these things, but unfortunately they have to have the crisis first, right? They have to have the burnout experience.
Right.
They have to have, you know, where their hair is falling out and they've lost all the zeal for life and they don't know what to do. And it just, unfortunately, that's what it takes. It takes us hitting that rock bottom or that major crash to go, you know, my life is not working at this level anymore. I have to do some massive changes.
You're so right, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I wanted to get to people before they hit the crisis so they could see what is not normal. You know, this normal that
right.
we have is not normal. It's not natural with our biology, and it will lead to the crash. So it's about bringing that awareness up, as you said, before you hit a crisis and realizing, hey, this eye twitch, it's not going to kill me, but it's really not a good indicator. Something is wrong, and I need to take a look at this.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that eye twitch. What is going on? That should be that's funny. Okay, let's talk about this, because I think this intrigues me, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because you talk about tricking your brain to get past self-sabotaging behaviors. And I think that a lot of us deal with some kind of self-sabotage on some level. Talk about this.
Yeah. So we have a brain that is designed for surviving on the savannah. So we have 5 times as many neural processes for negative thinking as positive thinking. So that served us when danger was approaching and was going to eat us, or when somebody not from our tribe was going to come on and kill us and take our women. But that's not the case anymore. But what we don't realize is of those some 60,000 thoughts in our day, we don't notice that it's coming from this negative programming. We just think the thoughts are true. And we act on them as if they're true. And we sabotage our results. Just really simple little example. Let's say you're giving a big presentation to an investor or the board or your boss. And the most important influencer in the room is yawning. Now, a really mindful person who notices their thoughts could say, oh, I just noticed I had a thought about that, when really I don't know anything about why he's yawning or she's yawning.
Right.
So we get to make up the story, but we often forget that we get to make up the story. So we default to, for example, I'm boring. He's not interested in what I have to say. And then that leads to actions like we stutter, we stammer, we lose our confidence, our tone changes, our body language changes, and then guess what? We become ineffective. It's a vicious cycle. But we can turn it into a virtuous cycle. We could, we could think, wow, this person's really tired, and yet they still came, and they're still paying attention, and they're still taking notes. I wonder if he didn't sleep well.
Yes.
Think how different that feels. So now we feel empathy and other-focused and gratitude instead of fear, embarrassment, shame, all those other things. It was an option. We got to choose the story.
Yeah, I think that this is a great example of looking at your environment and jumping to a conclusion, right? And I think that this is a great example of not knowing what's really happening with the person that's yawning, but yet you take that upon yourself. I'm boring. I'm putting this person to sleep. You don't realize that, hey, you know, this person just had a child and he is sleep deprived because he has, you know, because his newborn is keeping him up every night, or something along those lines. And yet we jump to this negative assumption that we're doing it. And I think, to me, as simple as this example is, I think it hits home, because we all do this on some level. And I have 2 teenage girls at home, and this is a constant conversation that we talk about, where somebody starts acting different towards them, and they think it's, you know, and they automatically say, well, I don't know what I did wrong. Well, maybe you didn't do anything wrong. Maybe they're having a crisis. Maybe they're doing something wrong. What do you call it? But you can see how your example, I mean, it can bleed out to all areas of our life.
Absolutely. And I like that you brought up your daughters, because we do this at every age, and we do this with our partners, with our coworkers, with ourselves, with our children, with our pets. You know, we make these assumptions all the time when we could just get curious and check it out. See if we can come up with a better story, or maybe we can even ask questions of the person that we're making assumptions about. That's not always available. You know, if somebody cuts you off in traffic, you can't, you know, call the person and say, hey, I was just curious. Are you having a bad day? Was that intentional? We can't do that. But we can still absolutely make up a story. I mean, I love this quote by Sean Stevenson that is, beliefs are thoughts you decided to make true.
Mm.
So what do you want to believe about that car that just cut you off? You know, I like to think, wow, they must be running late to something. I bet they didn't sleep much and their motor control isn't very great. You know, that makes me feel better than, you know, that jerk can't drive. Now, I will go to that jerk can't drive impulsively, and then I have to pull back and say, wow, that doesn't feel good. I'm going to shift that story.
Yes. You know, it's so important because we're constantly making up stories about, as you said, this random driver that cut us off. And so I think it's so, powerful. And again, this is one of those simple things that it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, doesn't matter your race, your gender, it doesn't matter where, you know, what area of the world you live in, you can immediately change that conversation in your head and allow it to empower you versus limit you.
Right. If of all the tips I give in the book, this one, upgrading your thoughts, is the most important one, because if you don't learn this, then nothing else is going to stick. This is why, you know, people go on diets and they lose 30 pounds and then they gain it right back. They didn't learn to manage the thought that was producing the emotion that led them to overeat. So you have to go to the root, and if you do that, then all the other tips in my book will be so much easier, so much lasting, and it just takes practice. We are not in the practice of being third-party observers of our thought. So the more you do it, the easier it gets, and that's when you become responsive instead of reactive, and that in and of itself is going to change your life for good.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Talk about reducing your stress all that other stuff. Oh, let's talk about this. Let's talk about goals. You know, the goals are something that a lot of people sometimes ignore, and, you know, we have a small percentage of the world that actually writes them down, and then they don't do a whole lot, and, you know, and a lot of people are very blasé about goal setting. Give me your process for achieving goals.
So the most important step, I would say, is answering the question, why? And this was, I first heard this from Tony Robbins. So you may have a goal out there, but your brain does not want you to change. Your brain likes you to stay in the cave, away from anything that might eat you or harm you. So now that means your brain would like you to just sit on the couch and watch Netflix and eat Ben and Jerry's ice cream, because that feels good and safe. So if you're going to change, you have to give your brain something really delicious to go for. So why do you want to achieve this goal? And then you create an inspiring vision of yourself on the other end of this, answering the question, why? The other mistake people make besides answering the question why is they don't get enough support. They think, I can just do it on my own. They tell themselves, well, I should have enough willpower to do this. And that's not true. Our brains have almost zero willpower. And the more tired you are, the more hungry you are, the more frustrated you are, the less you have willpower. So get support, whether it's a coach, a personal trainer, a dietitian, a financial analyst, whatever it is. There is a person out there for any task you're needing help with. And then don't just leave it to chance and tell yourself, okay, I'm going to do this every day. No. I want you to create reminders, schedules, rituals that work for you. For example, if you're going to start exercising every day, your ritual might be that you lay out your workout clothes and you put your shoes beside the bed, and before your feet touch the ground, your feet go into your shoes. That could be a ritual. For other people, they might put notes, sticky notes on their refrigerator or on their laptop. notes that say breathe, notes that say ask open-ended questions, and then they literally write down the open-ended questions they're going to ask. Because if you don't put these tricks and tools in place, you're going to forget to do it until it's too late, and then you're going to beat yourself up. Along those lines, the other thing is wherever you can, remove temptation. So back to a simple example, if you're on a diet, get rid of all the junk food in your house. Because again, when you've had a rough day, your brain is going to want you to go to that junk food because it brings you pleasure. It mitigates the pain of your day. But if you don't have anything, any junk food in your house, then you have to go to something else. And this is where we get to the next step, which is rewarding yourself. So fill your house with foods that you love that are also healthy for you. And it's kind of fun to even think about that and do research on that. What do I love that will also not only satiate me, but leave me feeling good about that interaction with that meal or that snack? And the last one is notice yourself talk about your identity. So let's go back to the example of the person giving a presentation and he's yawning. What is your story about how you give presentations? Do you compare yourself to other people and say, I'm kind of boring, I'm average, whatever it is? You're going to need to upgrade that story to something like, I am a person who gives authentic and compelling conversations with others. Whatever works for you. But we know from research that just, for example, people who want to stop smoking, those who change their identity to, I am a non-smoker, then when they inevitably fell off the wagon and had a cigarette, they didn't beat themselves up. They just said, I'm a non-smoker who had a situation where I took a cigarette, and now I can research that and go back and look and see what was going on that made me decide that. They're going to be much more successful than people who still have this identity of, I'm a smoker who's trying to quit. When they have a cigarette, they're going to beat themselves up and say, see, I always knew I was going to fail because I'm a smoker.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subtle shift, but it's really important. And you need to start with something small that you can believe. Like if you're going to have a goal of exercising every day, well, you probably don't want to say, I'm a person who runs marathons, because your brain's not going to believe that. But you could say, I am a person who takes the stairs every day, or I am a person who moves throughout the day.
Yeah, I love those tips. Those are great, especially the whole thing about temptation and setting up your rituals. Real simple stuff. It's so funny that you mentioned the whole eating thing, because this is something that happens to all of us. I'm fairly good on my diet. I'm fairly, I want to say, controlling, or, you know, I stick to my meal plan, for lack of better terms, right? But every now and then, I'm like everybody else. I come home, I'm starving, and everything I want to eat is going to require, you know, prep or cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I try to eat quite a lot of salads, but, you know, salads take time. I'm hungry right now, so I will, you know, open up the cabinet and a pantry or whatever, and I normally don't eat chips. But let me tell you, at the right moment when I'm really hungry and I'm also really lazy, I don't want to prep anything, I will eat some chips. I will grab whatever I can, and it's just human nature. All of us get weak sooner or later.
That's right, and that's one of the reasons why I tell people to pack almonds or walnuts in their drawer at work and at home, so that when they go to that afternoon meeting and the colleague brings the gooey cookies, they smell delicious, but you don't have the need for them because you have this other thing to distract you that's crunchy and good for you and takes time to eat but is instantly prepared.
Yes, and you know, the other thing that I, again, this is just one of my habits, conversations that I do when somebody presents me with gooey treats, is I look at that gooey treat and I'll say, hey, that's 15 or 20 or 30, that, you know, that's an hour on a treadmill or an hour on the elliptical, you know. I don't want to spend, you know, I don't want to spend 30 minutes getting rid of that cookie. Now, that doesn't mean I never eat junk food, but I really do try to limit it. I think that, again, not to go off on a tangent, but I think that we have so much sugar in our lives, and I think sugar adds to our stress levels. And I think sugar is one of those insidious things that is just commonplace and people don't think about it. But so anyway, everything nowadays has sugar.
Yeah, so what you did was brilliant because you upgraded your thought about it, and the brain is only motivated by avoiding pain or moving toward pleasure, and avoiding pain is a much bigger one. So what you did with the cookie was you switched the cookie from the pleasure network to the pain network, and that's brilliant. That's what we all need to do. With a recent client of mine, he had an inspiring vision of being around and alive when his 5-year-old sons graduated high school. And meanwhile, he's in his 50s and he has diabetes and high blood pressure. So he had the vision. And then I tossed out some possible thoughts for him. And the one that landed for him was that sugar was poison. Because he had a sugar addiction, like so many of us. I mean, Monsanto is putting sugar in their food and additives in their food that taste delicious, so we'll get hooked and we'll come back and all that. So he now was roaming the grocery store looking at all the things that he had once enjoyed, thinking, that's going to kill me. It's poison. And it worked for him. And just within the short time we worked together, it was a couple months that he had left with me in group coaching after he came up with this belief, he lost 8 pounds. So it works when you upgrade your thoughts. But if he had just gone through the grocery store without that belief that sugar is in poison, every single step of the way he would have been tempted.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know what? And it's one of those scenarios too, that saying I'm not going to have sugar, sugar is poison, is a much better thought than I'm going to moderate my sugar or I'm going to reduce my sugar, because that's much harder to do. Fasting,
right,
in most cases, is much easier than I am going to, you know, skip whatever. I'm going to skip a meal. Fasting is much easier because you're committed to doing it the whole day. It's easier. You're not worried about, oh, how much and measuring this or that. You wrote an article, by the way, I want to bring this up. You wrote an article on moneyforlunch.com, 4 Achievable Steps for Turning Burnout into Brilliance is the name of the article. You can find it there at moneyforlunch.com. One of the things in that article that I wanted to bring up in today's interview is something that caught my attention, and I was kind of intrigued by this, and I want you to talk about this. Managing your relationships with technology. Talk about this.
Yes, so I think your listeners can probably all relate to this one. But for the most part, I don't think we use technology. I think we let it use us. I don't think we're mindful about it. I think we're addicted to it. And I don't think it's anybody's fault. I think the app designers, Facebook, they understand what hooks people. And they understand how to, I mean, I'm watching my daughter right now play this game. Oh, and I'm really struggling with it because I can tell she's getting addicted. They build in all the little rewards. And, you know, we had games like that when we were kids, but they were not so sophisticated. I mean, I grew up in the 70s,
right,
and, you know, I remember I had a Simon machine where it, you know, worked on my memory. Or we had Rubik's Cubes, which were addictive in a good way. It was in a problem-solving way, and it made us determined to beat our next score. But now we've got all these lights and flashing and sound notifications, and our brains are not wired to take in all these inputs. So one of the dangers, besides getting addicted to it, is that it distances us from other people, and it distances us from our purpose. So if you roll out of bed and you check email, you have just turned over your agenda to everybody in your inbox. You have lost control of your day. So instead, we can be mindful, and we can build in rituals. Again, we can take off the offensive apps that hook us from our phones. We can just remove them. We can set our phones to do not disturb or turn them off all night. And then instead of checking email in the morning, we can use them mindfully. The first app I open up in the morning is a breathing app called My Calm Beat. I set it for an average of 8 minutes, 5.5 breaths per minute, and I do that. That's the first thing I do. And it has me feeling calm. It has me feeling good about how I started the day. It has me feel empowered because I've outsmarted my phone and used it for good. So I would just invite people to go through their day and notice how they're using technology. You know, when you sit and binge watch Netflix, are you doing it because you blocked off 4 hours to watch Games of Thrones? Or great. If that was your plan and that was your reward for great work, go for it. Or are you now cutting into your sleep that had been planned because you're addicted to a show? Just
right.
Notice. How are you using technology, or is it using you?
Yeah. I think that's a, you know, it's interesting again that you bring that up, because that was something I caught myself doing. I would sit there and binge watch. And it's one thing to binge watch a show, you know, hey, I have, you know, you're going to watch whatever, 4 or 5 hours of it, which is ridiculous when I say it out loud. But I was doing this on a regular basis. I would watch 3 hours of NCIS or 3 hours of some other show. And, you know, I just said, this is ridiculous. First of all, this stuff is recorded, so I can watch it anytime. Second of all, I've seen all these shows. I'm watching NCIS from the beginning again, you know, and so I've seen all these shows. And the same thing with one of my other favorite shows is Burn Notice and stuff like that. And anyway, my point being is I woke up to this addiction, and I set a daily alarm that at 8 o'clock I shut off technology. I start winding down, and that means that since I started this little ritual, I've spent more time with my wife. I've spent more time with, again, my two kids that I have left at home. I finished several projects that I had been goofing around with. And because I've recaptured that time, I can look at this and say, you know what, this is worth an hour of my time today. But anyway, so what's happened in this very short time is I'm getting to bed earlier, which is all good. I keep a Fitbit on me. And so since I started getting off my addiction of binge watching, my sleep went from an average of 5.5 hours a day to 7 hours a day. And let me tell you, it's a world of difference.
It is. That's incredible. So I can't give a better example than that. You have just really pulled it all together in a great example. And so I just want to, if we're ending, I just want to comment on your note about sleep, because as you know, there's a whole chapter in my book about sleep, so I take it very seriously. But there are books out there on sleep, and the reason is, again, we used to consider it a badge of honor that, oh, I only had 4 hours of sleep last night, but it's not honorable. You will not be your best self. There is such a tiny fraction of the public who can thrive on less than 7 hours. Most of us need between 6.5 and 9 hours. So you got to find what works for you and then rearrange your schedule. And people think it's going to be impossible, but look at what you did. If other people look at their schedule and say, what am I doing that is filler, that is unnecessary? What can I say no to so that I meet this goal of getting to bed by whatever time I need to get to bed in order to get 7 or 8 hours of sleep?
Yeah. Yeah. It is ridiculous, and part of the addiction to technology is that it's so easy. Because, you know, if you're binge watching, you know, you can, another show is going to start in like 15 seconds, so you don't have to even get up to touch the remote. Or if you want, you can actually hit play, and it'll immediately start playing the next episode. There are no commercials, which makes it nice. There's just so many things. And back to what you were saying about gaming apps, you know, they are more sophisticated. There is, for anybody who wants to do the, if you jump on YouTube, 60 Minutes did a whole thing on exactly what you were talking about, that they build in all these little rewards that keep you addicted to the app. And this guy talks about all the sophistication that goes into these apps, into these games. And it's a huge multi-billion dollar market for a reason.
That's right.
Denise, this has been so much fun having you on the show. Again, I want to give out the name of the book is called, here it is, Work-Life Brilliance. Yeah, Work-Life Brilliance, Tools to Break Stress and Create the Life and Health You Crave. Work-Life Brilliance. I just love that title. And Denise, if people want to find out more about you, where can they go?
So, well, they can go to my Amazon author page, or they can go to my website, brillianceinc.com, that's INC.com, and all of the resources in the book, the assessments, the tools, the charts, they are also on my resources tab on the website. So just enter your email, we'll send you a link so you can get access to it, and that way you can start using them today. And I think that's the best way. Also on Twitter, I am Brilliance Inc., and on Facebook, I'm Evoke Brilliance.
I love it. I love it. Denise R. Green, thank you so much. If you want to catch up with Denise, check out the free resources. Go to brillianceinc.com. Denise, looking forward to having you back again.
Thanks, Bert. It's been fun. Appreciate it.
All righty. Good stuff there from Denise R. Green. From Burnout to Brilliant. I love that. All right. What's happening? We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Kathy Fetke. Kathy Fetke is... been on the show numerous times. Always good to have her on the show. Kathy is the co-CEO and co-founder of Real Wealth Network, based out of Walnut Creek, California, an organization dedicated to helping members get the most current and cutting-edge education and information they need to succeed as real estate investors. Kathy Fetke, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you.
All right, so let me ask you this. Right now, this is my opinion, and I definitely want to get your opinion on this. Right now, it seems like the real estate market is so crazy expensive. We're paying, in my opinion, this inflated high retail prices. Starter homes are an all-time high. As a real estate investor, what do you do in a scenario like this?
Well, everything ebbs and flows, and very often investors and people forget that. So if you just kind of rewind a little and you went back 10 years ago, we'd be in the exact same place, a little bit higher. In some markets now, home prices are past the last bubble. And this has pretty much been the case for every decade, where we hit a peak, then there's kind of a recession of sorts, and then there's a comeback, and it's a wild comeback that goes a little bit higher than the last peak. So that's where we are today in some markets, not all markets. In fact, 60% of U.S. markets have not hit their peak. In fact, they're still in recovery, and there's still affordability in 60% of the country. But as is the case, most people, the largest population, lives in just a handful of markets. And those are the ones that, just like every decade, they take off and get to a point of unaffordability, which is where we're at.
Right. And I guess that is part of being a real estate investor, is that you have to find the markets that you can invest in. So you either have the choice of holding your money and looking for deals, or waiting for the market condition to change, right?
Well, you just have to know what you're doing and understand what you're doing. So let me just give you an example. I live in Malibu, California, possibly the most expensive place in the country, or one of them. And there's people
yes.
who are making money. You know, they're making cash flow here because they have a certain strategy that works. And here in Malibu, you know, you might laugh a little bit, but it's people rent out or buy huge mansions, 11, 12, 13 room mansions, and they turn them into rehab centers and charge, you know, $100,000 a month per room or something to celebrities, and they're making money hand over fist. You know, you've got some people in Phoenix where you have definitely prices back up beyond affordability, but there's a lot of people creating senior housing. They'll buy a 4 or 5 bedroom house and turn it into senior living, and they make money. But, you know, those are all fairly active businesses. You just have to know what you're doing, and there's always opportunity. If you're like me and you just want to buy a house and rent it out and kind of keep it more passive, then you need to be in affordable markets. And that's what I'm constantly looking at, is where are the areas where there's job growth, there's population growth, but the housing recovered yet, and you can still find cash flow.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. All right, so you mentioned that we are in this situation that looks very analogous to where the market crashed roughly 10 years ago, 9 years ago. Do you getting a sense that, as an investor, are you getting that sense that it may crash? Are you having that expectation?
You know, here's the thing, that real estate is not the problem today so much. I think it was 30% of purchases over the last decade nearly were cash. And a lot of foreign money coming in, a lot of investors, institutional buyers, and people who did get loans, oh boy, they had to give blood samples, you know, to get the, to get the loan. I mean, the market is solid. And people who own real estate today, they own it because they can afford it. So mm-hmm. I don't see any kind of housing crash because of housing. But if there was an economic crisis and people lost their jobs, well, you know, that's going to affect housing. So that's more what I'm keeping my eye on today, is where are other problems that could affect housing? And that might be the stock market. Now, yeah, sure, I see that as a huge bubble, at least some of it, not all of it. And if people, you know, who started to lose money in their stock portfolios, they might need to sell their real estate, you know, or if they just lose their job and can't make their payments. So, you know, that's where I'm watching carefully. And boy, that's who knows what's happening there.
Right.
You know, it just keeps going up when you think it won't. And so I got my eye on it, but I it's hard to predict.
Yeah, it is so, what do you call it, interesting. Because I'm like looking to invest in real estate, and I like investing locally. I'm looking at maybe getting involved in apartment complexes. And Phoenix, unfortunately, does not have a great apartment complex market or multifamily home market. They are starting to make up for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I go to Houston because that's where I grew up, and I kind of know that market a little bit. So mm-hmm. if you're talking to investors in your, you know, members of your investment group, when people are looking to invest out of their market, mm-hmm. out of the, you know, their local market, what are some of the things that I and other investors should be aware of?
Well, I love that you said Houston, because now that's a market that we've, as a network at Real Wealth Network, helped investors buy in for probably 15 years. Back in 2005, before the bubble, or as the bubble was building in California, we were telling people, this is a really good time to sell. You're at a peak here, and Texas is just at the beginning of its boom. So you could sell one property in California and buy five in Texas and quintuple your cash flow. Now, as we know, Texas prices have gone up too, but to me, it's still in the affordability range. And what I love about Houston and Dallas is they are very diversified markets. So when we had a massive recession, you know, the Great Recession and the housing meltdown, it didn't affect Texas that badly. The properties that we bought there, I don't even know if they went down in value, and we certainly didn't leave any rents were not didn't go down. They went up, if anything, because so many people, you know, were moving there. So, you know, I would say, and this is what I tell people, look for growth. Where is their growth happening? And it's not that hard to figure out. You know, call the Chamber of Commerce. Look at, you know, read trade magazines. Find out where growth is and what's coming in the future, the path of progress, what cities are reinvesting in themselves and where. And that's where you want to buy. Atlanta's a great example. It's a place where it's been harder and harder to get cash flow because prices have gone up. But there's parts of Atlanta that are completely getting revitalized. They're putting in this new park that just circles the city on the train tracks, kind of the same way the High Line in New York was done. They took an old train and turned it into a park, a walking path. They're doing that in Atlanta. I think it's called the Beltline or something. And they're taking old, dilapidated neighborhoods and renovating. So we see that as a massive opportunity because Atlanta has job diversification as well.
Right. I like that. And when you're talking about diversification, again, Houston, you're talking about economic diversification in the sense that Houston has the oil business, the medical business, you know, is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly it. The biggest mistake I made, well, I've made several, but back in 2005 or six, my husband and I followed the trends and bought some houses in Boise, Idaho, because, you know, everybody in the investor community was saying, oh my gosh, what a great place, and people are moving there from California. Well, you know, after the housing collapse, you know, prices went down, and the problem was there was only one or two employers there. And one of those employers left. So there was job losses, and we were stuck with houses that we couldn't rent. And then I saw a lot of investors buy properties in North Dakota when there was an oil boom. But let me tell you, the only thing happening in North Dakota was the oil boom and maybe some strip clubs too, you know, for all the guys there that were working. That was the industry. You know, that was it. And so when oil collapsed, well, all the people that bought homes in North Dakota, same thing, having trouble renting them. Texas went through that in the 80s with the S&L crisis. They were way too dependent on oil. When oil crashed, the economy crashed, and the government said never again. And they brought in, they made it probably one of the most business-friendly places in the world, and it worked. And now there's a part of Dallas that's called Headquarter Row, and it goes for miles and miles and miles of, you know, company headquarters. Toyota just moved up there, their headquarters. So it's definitely, if there's an oil crisis, Dallas isn't feeling it, right? And there is an oil crisis, and the area is still booming because of that, you know, diversification. Houston's a little more dependent on oil, but still, it's a thriving economy, and it's not too deeply affected by the recent oil crash.
Right, right, absolutely. You know, I remember I lived in Houston when the oil had crashed, the stock market had crashed, and of course, eventually the real estate market crashed. And it was one of those things where it would have been such a wonderful time to be in real estate as an investor because you could have picked up so many sweet deals.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
oh, yeah.
You know, you just hold on to it. I know a friend of mine who was in a great position, and he started buying apartment complexes because, again, they had lost a lot of value. People were moving out. And so he was able to get just ridiculous deals on these apartment complexes. He bought three or four of them and just was able to hold on to them and just crushed it. Was able to retire as from being a lawyer and became a multimillionaire from these investments that he took advantage of during this down market.
Yeah, now, fast forward, a lot of people got great deals on apartments, and they tell their friends, and their friends are saying, I want to be in apartments, but it's not the same market. And there's so much money chasing apartments today that cap rates are just declining every month. And yet investors are still buying these things. If you buy an apartment with a 5 cap or even a 4, I mean, some people are, you know, in California are buying 1 and 2 or 0, you know, with the belief that they can raise rents and then the value of the property will go up. Well, what if the opposite happens? What if we did have a recession, there were job losses or you know, salary wage decreases, and now you're having to lower your rents? The same benefits you get when rents go up are the same disasters when rents go down. I mean, your apartment, you can make millions on an apartment if you just raise rents a little bit. That's just how it works. But if you lower rents, you lose millions. And people are forgetting that, you know, you're kind of buying apartments at the peak. And if there's any adjustment on rents, you are going to be a loser. And so just, be careful. Be careful in the apartment world and just don't buy too low of cap rates unless you're going to do something. We bought an apartment across from Google in Mountain View, California, in the Silicon Valley, and we got a 1 cap. I mean, there's no return. But we're taking the 200 units and re-entitling into 800 units, tearing the old building down. I mean, now that's a different kind of deal. But,
sure.
You know, we certainly didn't buy it for the 1% return.
Right. And again, this is one of the scenarios where, Kathy, how long have you been investing in real estate?
Kind of by accident, 20 years ago, but actively about 15.
So you're a veteran investor of 15 years, and you feel confident that, hey, I can take this deal here. You know, it's giving me a lousy 1% return, but I'm not in it for that. I'm in it because I'm going to recertify this property or remodel this property and hopefully get a much bigger return, but you're also taking a bigger risk. So it's not maybe a deal for a newbie investor or maybe who is somebody who, like myself, who's has some modest amount of experience. I wouldn't do a deal like that. I'm just not ready for it. Wouldn't know what to do. Now, maybe if I had you and your husband as my partners, that might be different. So like any investment deal, you gotta look at your experience and your risk tolerance and decide if it's the right thing for you.
I cannot emphasize enough what you just said, that do not jump into something you don't understand or don't have a tremendous amount of experience in, because there's a good chance you will go to the very, very expensive school of hard knocks. It's just how it is. If any time I've thought I understood something and jumped into it, it was a struggle. Whereas what I do now, if I'm like right now, we're working on mobile home parks. Well, I don't have experience in that, but it's a wonderful opportunity because it's affordable. So I'm working with people who have years and years of experience. The same with when you mentioned the apartment. I've never re-entitled an apartment and tore it down and built a new one. We are partnering with a developer who's done that before and done it successfully. So that's, you know, if you're going to even just flip your first home, why try to do it on your own if you don't know how? There's just too many factors. Partner with someone on the first deal who's done it and has a successful track record. Then you can learn from them. Even if you have to split the gain, it's going to be a better return than trying to do it on your own where you might be facing a loss.
Yes, because the name of the game is to gain, is to make money. I'd rather make little money than no money.
Exactly.
And sometimes people forget that. Yeah, I mean, listen, if I can team up with somebody and now I'm going to learn something and make money along the way, to me, that's that's a double win because, maybe on the next deal or the deal after that, I can do it solo. And it's a game changer. When I am investing in a deal, this is my mentality. I look at the deal, I do as much homework as I obviously know how to do. And then ultimately I look at the deal and say, okay, what's worst case scenario? Worst case scenario, this deal tanks. There's something I didn't know. There's a skeleton that pops out. Can I afford to lose this deal? Can I afford for this deal? And if the answer is yes, then I'll pull the trigger. because I'm not dependent on it, right? It's not my, you know, my nest egg all rolled up into one deal. And that's kind of the way I do it. You know, it's just my risk tolerance, my risk assessment, I should say.
I am an extremely optimistic person. I always look for the opportunity and the benefit. I'll tell you what, that can be your enemy in real estate, because if you only can see the positive and the optimistic side of it and be excited, well, you're missing the whole, you know, the questions you should be asking, the what ifs. And a lot of times couples, you have an optimist and more of a questioner, an analyst. And you know, the more you can work together with different personalities, and that's one of the things I love about, you know, my company is we're in Silicon Valley and we attract a lot of really intelligent people. And whenever we present a project, they ask every possible question and everybody gets to hear those questions and the developer has to answer them. And so it's a lot of times you just sometimes don't even know the questions to ask. And so be careful of being too optimistic. It's a wonderful thing in life. It's a great trait to have, but as an investor, it can hurt you a lot.
Absolutely. You know, one of the shows that I have become addicted to, and I think that every investor, every novice investor, and possibly maybe even veterans should definitely look into, and that is Shark Tank. And when you look at Shark Tank, and luckily with today's technology, you can just jump on YouTube and they have these 10-minute snippets. And so typically Shark Tank will, you know, clobber people. The sharks just go in a frenzy if people don't know their numbers, right? It just pisses them off to no end. Second of all, I was watching a Shark Tank episode yesterday while doing my cardio, and they were all over these two ladies because these two ladies were so optimistic, could only see the upside, and the sharks took them to school for that, you know, that they're not being realistic. And so they ended up getting a deal, but they ended up giving away 70% of their company. So we'll see what happens. But when you look at Shark Tank, my favorite thing about Shark Tank is they're all about the numbers. They're brutal about the numbers. And I've seen several episodes where Kathy, they will say, "Hey, I'm out. I'm not really sure what it is that you're selling here. I don't understand your concept. And for me, if I can't clearly understand it, I'm out." And so that goes again, you know, for any investor, if you don't clearly understand something, you need to be out. And then the other thing that I see very common is somebody will say, "Hey, I love your concept." Mark Cuban does this quite a bit. "I like your concept. Congratulations. You know, you're doing really well, but it's not my niche. It's not my area of comfort. So for that reason, I'm not going to invest." And again, to me, there's so much there to learn about asking those questions, knowing your numbers, being clear, and doing something that you like to do, that you're comfortable doing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the key. Just, you know, in our company at Real Wealth Network, we have somebody. We always bring in somebody to just kind of be the bad guy at meetings. You know, like just look at all the ways things can go wrong. It's a tough position to be in, but it really makes the difference. And just like you, I can tell a new investor immediately because they don't give several scenarios. You've got to kind of present worst case, what you expect, and best case. And if it works, if the numbers work on the worst case, then you're probably good. This thing's probably going to work.
Right. Kathy Fetke, thank you so much for stopping by. If you guys want to find out more about Kathy Fetke and her team, they can go to realwealthnetwork.com. Is that right?
Realwealthnetwork.com. And yep, membership is free, and there's just a tremendous amount of learning and blogs and webinars we put on weekly, and my podcast that help people become savvy investors.
Kathy Fetke, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Good stuff there from real estate investor, educator, Kathy Fetke. And you can join her team for free at realwealthnetwork.com. Always good to have you guys stop by. Remember, share this with the people that you love. Let's help as many people as you can. Join me at youtube.com/BurtJMartinez. Love to have you there. I got some great videos up there that are fun, and you'll enjoy them. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.